From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When people talk about the five stages of grief, anger is second, right after denial. I realized this week that I have hit stage two. I am angry. Enraged, actually, as I watch my community, the independent restaurant community, suffer. Every week, there's a new article laying out the existential threat to the restaurant business. There's no doubt that it's in serious crisis, even free fall. People like comparing the airline industry to the restaurant business, so let's do that. The airlines employ 750,000 people. Independent restaurateurs employ 11 million people. That is 14 times more people who are able to earn a living, if you can call it that, in restaurants than with the airlines. When it comes to government support, airlines are a much easier sell. They are huge and they are concentrated, what some might call too big to fail. So far, airline-specific relief via the CARES Act has totaled more than $25 billion. The restaurant industry has received zero specifically targeted relief. You know, restaurants are small, tiny, infinitely diverse in their size, style, and makeup. They operate on a human scale, which is why we care so deeply about them. Everyone has a restaurant that they love. How many of you can say the same about an airline? Every restaurant is a story worth telling. It's why we started our series In the Weeds. Because maybe collecting all these small stories and adding them up over time will show us, show others, that this industry is really not so small at all. Consider Galleguetza. The story of the Lopez family who built the restaurant is extraordinary. Opened in 1994, Galleguetza introduced many Angelenos to their first taste of mole and the satisfying crunch of chapulines. It's now in the hands of the second generation. Ambricia Lopez, who runs it with her sister Paulina and brother Fernando, is here to share her story.
Hi, my name is Bricia Lopez, and I am the co-owner of Galleguetza Restaurant. Galleguetza is a regional Mexican restaurant. We focus on food from the Oaxaca region of Mexico, and we serve primarily our Oaxacan community and every Angeleno that loves great Mexican food. The reason why my family opened Galleguetza was because they needed to create a new life for themselves. We used to live in Oaxaca in the early 90s, and in 1994, my dad migrated to Los Angeles looking for a better life for his four children and his wife. And all he knew was how much himself and his fellow Oaxacanos loved food. So him and his sister decided to open a small restaurant in Los Angeles, and that's really how it all begun. I would say Galleguetza is not just intertwined with my identity, but it really is who I am. It shaped me. It saw me grow up. I've known Galleguetza, the restaurant, since I was 10 years old. I grew up there. I would do my homework there. I worked there since I could remember. I realized I wanted to take over the restaurant the moment my father told us that he was going to close for good. And that happened right after the economic recession of the mid-2000s. And it was at that moment when I realized that I needed to stop playing hanky-panky at work and I needed to take it serious, because my dad's life was going to be for nothing. Like, the idea that his work that he had done for close to 20 years at that moment was going to be forgotten, it really hit me to the core, and I realized that I needed to step up and we needed to continue it just for the legacy and for the sake of my parents and for ourselves as well. I realized really what Galleguetza means to the community, to the Oaxacan community, to a lot of immigrant families, a lot of Oaxacan immigrant families, is this is where they create a lot of memories. This is what connects them to where they come from. And it just kind of dawned on me that if that was gone, our entire identity would be gone. So it pushed me to step into the role I was born to be in. So COVID has impacted us in many different ways. For one, it kind of brought me to this place where I realized that I really had no option to fail. Kind of brought me back to remembering where we come from, where Gelaguetza started. Gelaguetza started out of nothing, from a 34-year-old man who had zero education, did not know the language, did not know any rules or regulations. And to think about what my father created, it kind of led me to realize I cannot waste time feeling bad for myself, and I cannot sit here and just wait for someone to help me. I need to figure this out, because if my father did it, then I have zero excuse not to do it and not to survive this time. And it just allowed us to get creative. And one of the things that we always kind of dreamed about was having a beautiful outdoor patio that reminded us of having lunch at a mercado in Oaxaca. And somehow that never really came to be. And now when I walk into the restaurant, the first thing I see is their beautiful patio. It reminds me of being in Oaxaca. It reminds me of just being outdoor, you know, having like la yuda, having barbacoa with the music. It just kind of brings me a sense of just happiness, in a sense of like, oh my gosh, we're going to make it through this. The name Gelaguetza means reciprocity. It means to give and receive. It means that, you know, one cannot live without the other. And I think, especially right now during these times, it's such a great reflection of where we are as a restaurant, because we need of one another to survive. And I'm also so thankful for every single person, every single customer that has been patient with us, because believe me, there were some dark days where we didn't we were trying to figure out our to go or take out, and we just messed up. And people were so patient with us. You know, I think it just made us stronger, and it made us believe that we have a bigger purpose to fulfill in this city. And just to see the support from families and from our neighborhood, it's been so fulfilling. You know, I'm a mom of two. My son is 5 years old. Right now, you know, my son goes to the restaurant here and there. He's not there all the time. And I think his experience is definitely going to be very different than mine. You know, I grew up there working every single day, busing tables. And I definitely want my son to work in the service industry at some point in his life. But I think that the legacy that I want to leave behind, it's not so much as him having the same experience that I did growing up in my restaurant, but I just want him to see that his mom is doing something she loves every day. I love promoting our culture. I love being a person that can give someone experiences and who can showcase and introduce people to our great Oaxacan culture and food. So if you were to come to Gelaguetza for dinner tonight, number one, you have to start with a plate of chapulines. They're like the better version of dried shrimp. They're delicious. I would order for sure our chile relleno with chicken. It's incredible. I think it will change your perception of what a chile relleno should be. Definitely a clayuda with our three meats. Our mole. I always encourage people to try our mole negro through a tamal de mole. It's a different experience that way. And our taco de barbacoa. But I think those are definitely my top five. If it's your first time in Gelaguetza, I always encourage people to order those.
That was Bricia Lopez. Together with her siblings, she's carrying on her family legacy at Gelaguetza in Koreatown. This new series, In the Weeds, is a perfect example of why radio is such a powerful medium. When else can you hand the mic to someone and let them tell their own story in their own words? That's the power of radio and the power of KCRW. We're in the middle of our Power in Numbers drive right now, and I'm asking you, dear listener, to count yourself in. If you appreciate hearing the stories of independent restaurant owners, then please support independent radio. Show your support by going to kcrw.com/give or call 800-600-KCRW. That's 800-600-5279. One of the great powers of this show is that you know people listening are going to go get in their cars or pick up their phone and order from the places they hear about on the show. You can hear about a special birria in East LA or kimbap in Koreatown, then literally go and get it within the hour. That immediacy is so powerful. You can go to Gelaguetza and order at Tlayuda tonight. I heard from many of you who ordered dosas from Mayura and takeout from Hapu. It brings me incredible joy to know that what you hear on Good Food goes beyond the speakers in your car or the earbuds in your ear. It becomes a part of your life, your daily rituals. I know you all value independent restaurants as much as I do, and today I'm asking you to make your pledge to independent radio. KCRW is not immune to this economic crisis, but we know there is power in numbers. If everyone listening right now commits whatever amount they can to support Good Food, it will make a huge impact. Let's do it together. Go to kcrw.com/give and stay with us, because after a quick break, we're going to continue our conversation about the value of independent restaurants, who is winning and who is losing the fight for survival.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Good Food. Back in July, Amazon's Jeff Bezos added $13 billion to his net worth in a single day. Growth in the restaurant industry is booming as well. Clearly, it's not at your favorite small neighborhood establishments, but at big chains like McDonald's, Chipotle, and Domino's. Heather Haddon covers restaurants for the Wall Street Journal's Chicago Bureau, and she's here with more. Welcome to Good Food, Heather.
Thanks so much.
How many restaurants typically open and close in a regular year?
Yeah, so there's quite a lot of churn that happens in the restaurant industry, no matter what, even on a normal year. So the National Restaurant Association, the trade group that represents the sector, estimates that something like 60,000 restaurants open in any given year and 50,000 close. So clearly that is a lot of restaurants that close even in a normal year. But this year, because of the pandemic, they're predicting something like double that amount will close.
What's the demographic of most of these restaurants that we're talking about? The ones that go out of business every year and the additional ones that will be affected this year?
They tend to be independent restaurants, so small operations. Maybe an operator has one or a handful of restaurants, not necessarily well capitalized. Restaurants have always been a low margin business, single digit margins, and they really depend on a steady cash flow. So they depend on people coming and patronizing their restaurant on a regular basis and not huge disruptions like we have in this current pandemic, where downtowns, their tourists aren't back, business travelers aren't back, office workers are not back. And that's, a huge disruption for these independent restaurants. And this is not to say that chains don't also close restaurants. Chains also do certainly decide that a certain site isn't good for them anymore, that they need to shift away from a market. Markets change all the time, and they also will close restaurants. But it is that independent operator who has a lot less capital as a cushion that is more likely to close.
In addition to more capital, what other advantages do large operators have that allows them to keep their head above water?
So a lot of large operators had invested in all kinds of technology and convenience ordering before the pandemic. So certainly fast food chains have drive-throughs, but a lot of them had already struck deals with delivery companies to shutter their food, bring their food to people, have loyalty programs and apps where people can easily order food from them. And, you know, independent operators have also gotten into delivery, but some of them really didn't have any delivery experience before. They didn't have a drive-through. They didn't have an easy way to have people pick up food. And certainly a lot of them don't have loyalty programs. So this has been a whole learning curve for these operators to try to keep afloat when their dining rooms have closed. Another advantage for these chains is they have a lot of geographic diversity. So they will have, you know, restaurants in a place like Florida where the occupancy caps have been laxed and become more relaxed in most parts of the state, and in restaurants in New York where they're still quite tight. Whereas an independent operator, often their one restaurant is in their one location. So they really are at the whims of what that jurisdiction has decided to do in terms of occupancy, how many people can come into their dining rooms. And, you know, restaurant operators I talked to said that they really build their dining rooms for the occupancy they expect. So on, you know, especially on weekends, they expect that most of their tables will be full. Now, during the pandemic, especially on weekends, they've had to limit that, and that just totally changes their business model and really puts them at a disadvantage like they never have before.
Let's talk numbers. What kind of sales growth has been recorded by chains that are experiencing success during the second and third quarters of this year?
Yeah, so, you know, chains also had big losses early on in the pandemic, double-digit losses, because it just was such an unprecedented event. But they have started to come back, particularly during the summer. Like you said, we started to see reversals of those losses. So McDonald's just reported their third quarter preliminary earnings. And for the U.S., their same-store sales were up 4.6%. I mean, that is good for them on a normal year. So that is something they clearly can feel good about. Some pizza chains like Domino's, Papa John's, they have seen double-digit increases to their same-store sales because people want to eat pizza at home.
But not all chains are having this kind of success. Which ones are reporting losses or have filed for bankruptcy protection or who are actually closing locations?
Yeah, absolutely. Chains have also gotten hurt, particularly, you know, kind of casual dining brands that really have depended on people coming into their restaurants up until now. You know, a lot of these brands, just like some independent operators, didn't really have robust delivery to-go programs heading into the pandemic. So the closures of their dining rooms and the occupancy caps have hurt them. And, you know, chains that went into this also in a kind of financially distressed position, really, this has been the end to them for a lot of them. A lot of them have declared bankruptcy, are trying to reorganize, or are just going bankrupt, period. So like a California Pizza Kitchen headed into this situation with quite a lot of debt and with this dining model, they have filed for bankruptcy. They recently just did not get any qualified bidders to bid on the chain, which is not particularly a good sign. And then even some of the strong chains are, some would say, using this as an opportunity to close locations that, like I was saying before, the market has changed. Something about the layout of the store just doesn't work for this more convenience-oriented restaurant situation. And so they are closing stores. Dunkin' Donuts is closing something like 900 stores across the country right now that they, you know, are either based in convenience stores or just locations they say they want to pivot and reposition those stores elsewhere.
Overall, how much loss in dollars is projected for this year for the industry?
So the National Restaurant Association, I think the projection is something like a $240 billion loss. And this is a sector that does nearly $900 billion a year. So it is a huge sector. It's a big part of the economy and employs not just all the direct employees who work in restaurants, but it's all the suppliers and the ancillary businesses that are attached to restaurants. I mean, it's just a huge part of the U.S. economy. And, you know, the associations have been fighting for more stimulus. They say, like, the airlines, restaurants should get some kind of assistance. The House Democrats have pushed for 120, I believe it's billion in grants to restaurants, but that has not come through yet. So,
yeah, I mean, it's an enormous industry. Last year, you say in your article, the industry brought in more than the agriculture, airline, and rail transportation industries combined.
And, you know, restaurants are everywhere. They're in hospitals, in arenas, in stadiums. It's in airports, and it's in train stations. It's all over the map in ways, both big and small. And because of that, it's just a huge generator of sales and jobs in the U.S. economy, and is really a key employer. And that's something that the trade groups have really made as part of their argument, is why they deserve stimulus as well, is that they're such an important employer.
Do you think that restaurants will be redesigning how they're built to accommodate this new reality? Will we see foods that we don't normally associate with drive-through now available in drive-throughs?
Yeah, so I think a lot of restaurants prior to the pandemic had been devising plans to really reorient towards a more convenience-oriented customer, and they have pushed forward those plans much faster because of the pandemic. So a good example is Shake Shack. Shake Shack is a company that you really think of as New York City, as a place you walk up to, and you maybe even have to wait in a big line to get your Shack burger. But now, for the first time, they are going to have a drive-through location, and they intend to build several dozen more in the coming years. And so they are trying to keep the experience of a Shake Shack. You know, Shake Shack, you go for more of an experience because it is a treat. It is a little more expensive, obviously, than a McDonald's. But they realize that they need to have more convenience ordering for people. So there'll be a drive-through. There'll also be a pickup where you can park in designated parking spots, and they'll bring the food to you. They also are available for delivery and have signed more partnerships with different delivery companies. So they are really making bets here, and a lot of other companies are, that this is the way people are going to want to order food for a long time.
Yeah, maybe we'll see the return of the drive-in with car hops.
Yes, yeah. Actually, Taco Bell's plans for a reoriented type of restaurant includes what they call bell hops. So you will drive up and someone will bring you the food that you had ordered ahead of time, likely online or through an app, and that they will know when you drive up through various geolocation software, and someone will come and bring the food to you.
Wow. Well, thank you so much, Heather.
This was great. Thank you so much.
That's Heather Hadden. To read her full article for the Wall Street Journal, visit our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. It's really important to us at Good Food to always give you the full story. We want you to have the big picture, which is why we air stories like the one you just heard with journalist Heather Hadden. We've been talking for weeks about how independent restaurants are struggling, but talking to Heather paints a clearer picture of the wider food landscape and lets us know what's at stake if independent restaurants fail. Independent restaurants and independent radio are for independent thinkers like you. Now is the time to support the institutions that you love in any way you can. I'm asking you to do this one thing for Good Food, for me, and for KCRW right now. Give to KCRW. Your monthly support is the olive oil to my tomato sauce. It's the charcoal to the grill that fires the interviews, the voices, and the people we meet each week. I want to personally thank you, so when you make your donation, put Good Food in the comments so I'll be able to say your name on next week's show. Go to kcrw.com/give and join as a new member. Renew your membership or make an additional contribution. We really need it. It literally takes a minute. I know, because I did it. That's how much I believe in KCRW. I not only work here, but I'm a member too. Join me and go to kcrw.com/give and thanks. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. We're down to the Fuerte Four. It's the last leg of Gustavo and KCRW's Great Tortilla Tournament with me, Evan Kleiman. And Gustavo Arellano is back to highlight both the corn and flour tortillas that are still standing. Hi, Gustavo.
Hola, Evan.
When is the final competition?
It's this Sunday, October the 18th, 4 p.m. Pacific. Go to kcrw.com/tortilla and you can RSVP to our Zoom finale where you get to see me, you, KCRW's Mera Mera, Connie Alvarez, and Eater LA writer Mona Holmes, us four tortilla judges, eat the four finalists live.
Okay, so let's get down to the nitty gritty. What competitors remain in the contest?
So we're down to the final four, the Fuerte Four, as we call them, the strong four, the two corn finalists and the two flour finalists. And so I'll start with the corn because that was my category, mine and Connie's category. So you have Taco Maria, you know, the tortilla titan of Southern California. They won last year's tortilla tournament. Amazing, spectacular blue corn tortillas up against an unlikely rival, the other finalist, El Ruso from Boyle Heights. And El Ruso is very famous for its flour tortillas, and they make amazing Sonoran-style flour tortillas along with their tacos. But their secret weapon is their corn tortillas. They get their masa from the legendary Acapulco Tortilleria in East LA. And, oh, man, I mean, you're going to taste them. They're like, they make them by hand. They're a little bit gorditas, so a little bit thicker with yellow corn and just this earthiness that was so delicious, it beat last year's finalist, Kernel of Truth.
And what about on the flour side? Well, I should chime in there since
yeah,
I was...
Yeah, you should chime in because that's yours.
So it came down to Home State, which has been a winner in the past. They're really incredible, powdery, very flaky tortillas. And El Cholo, which I've never tasted yet. So I am really looking forward to tasting the El Cholo flour tortilla, which is famous, I understand.
Oh, I mean, we have, of course, a national divide in this country right now with politics, but we also have a regional divide when it comes to Mexican food, Calmex versus Tex-Mex. And here are the great ambassadors of their respective tortillas. Of course, home state, Tex-Mex champion, the Valdez sisters just make amazing flour tortillas based on the recipe of their abuelita, their great restaurant there in Highland Park with all their great breakfast tacos. And then, of course, El Cholo is the third oldest Mexican restaurant in the United States. Everyone's been to El Cholo in Southern California, although probably the last time you went was for your aunt's retirement party or something. I knew you'd laugh because I knew it would hit true because it's true. All of us, we've all been to El Cholo, but we haven't been there in a while. So I was as surprised as anyone once I tasted their homemade flour tortillas. And you have to ask them by request, but oh my God, they're amazing. They're huge, almost like a sobaquera, the big hoop-sized Sonoran-style tortillas, which would make sense because the founders of El Cholo Cafe, the grandparents of Ron Salisbury, the current owner, they were from Sonora. So here's a recipe that is unchanged for over 100 years that uses milk. And you talk about the flakiness of home state. Oh, the El Cholo tortilla is almost like shortbread. It's so rich. It's so fatty. It's so delicious.
Wow. You know, I'm completely out of flour tortillas. I'm waiting for this. So excited. So I guess what happens when we get together is we're going to all taste the two corn and then decide on one, and then we'll all taste the flour and decide on one, and then the really, really hard part. And every year I push to have two winners because, you know, I'm me. And like, it's like comparing apples and oranges, comparing corn and flour tortillas.
I do not believe that to be true. I do think, though, that we should, it's just like in baseball. You are like, you know, I hope the Dodgers finally win the World Series this year. But if not, you know, or at least go to the World Series, they'll be the National League champs. They've been the National League champs 2 years in a row. That's a great achievement unto itself that should be hailed. So last year, the two winners was Taco Maria for corn and home state for flour, but you have to match them up. How can you not match them up? And the winner between those, they're the ones who get to take home the golden tortilla.
This is true. But, you know, there isn't an award for the best football team against the best baseball team.
Well, you did have Floyd Mayweather Jr. fight Conor McGregor a couple of years ago. So this has been true. But also that is comparing apples to oranges, because baseball is a different sport than football. Their only shared attribute is a ball and, you know, way overpriced tickets nowadays. But a tortilla is a tortilla. Yeah, it's two completely different leagues. So, of course, this shows who's a real sports fan and Evan, who kind of likes sports.
Oh, not at all. This is what happens when a single female child is raised by a single female parent. A lot of indoor reading and reheating of tortillas. You know, this morning I made myself breakfast and a couple of eggs with some Green Hatch chili salsa that I made earlier in the week. And I pulled out a couple of the Tehachapi Grain Project tortillas that I had stashed in my freezer. And I just have to say, one of the greatest parts of this contest is how much you learn by tasting the breadth of what's on offer here in Southern California. So let's talk about the areas that we can find each of these tortillas in. The final four.
Oh my God. I mean, so for the finalist, for the corn, you get Taco Maria's in Costa Mesa. So you have to go down Orange County, but it's totally worth the drive. For El Russo, you go to Boyle Heights. It's a little taco stand right there in Boyle Heights and off of Union Pacific. And then for Flower, Homestead has a couple of locations. Their most famous one is in Highland Park, but there's also one in East Hollywood. And they just reopened the one in Playa de Rey, Mar Vista, that whole area. And it's right across the street from Loyola Marymount. And of course, Cholo is a chain now, so they have locations everywhere from Anaheim Hills to the one in Irvine closed, but the famous one off of Western Avenue, they're all around. But the best thing about it is, you know, we're encouraging everyone to join us for the Zoom finale. If you're a KCRW member, this is one of the many perks of being a KCRW member. You show your card to one of these four people, your fringe benefits card, and you'll get 15% off those tortillas, because we want the folks not just to see us eating these tortillas, but to try them for yourselves. And, you know, every year we have a people's choice, so, you know, go for it.
Hopefully next year we can do it in real life. But if we end up having to be virtual again, maybe we can arrange people to get special tortilla packs.
Yo, I definitely thought of that. This is my wife, who's, of course, Evan's very good friend. She thought of that, and we could have done that. But, of course, the thing is that we did this tortilla tournament in the time of a pandemic, so we tried to be as safe as possible. I'm just so happy that in buying all these tortillas and eating all these tortillas, all of us judges, we've been COVID-free, you know, thank God for this. But we couldn't put too many tortillas together. We couldn't hang out too much together. Hopefully by next year, there'll be some sort of vaccine or something that allows us to eat it together, and then just share all the wealth. If we can't have a big huge party like we've done in years past, at least we could just send out tortillas to anyone who wants them.
So just to run down some of the details, the event is free for KCRW members. A donation is required for non-members, but that could just be $1 or more. Tickets are issued with any donation amount. The Zoom link will be sent directly to you the day of the event, but if you can, give more. If you're donating for the first time, a donation of $30 or more will enroll you in KCRW's Fringe Benefits program, which is normally only available at the $60 level and above. So, Gustavo, while I have you here, I want to thank you for helping create a larger listening community for KCRW. As you know, we're in the middle of our Power in Numbers pledge drive. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you the number to call, 800-600-KCRW or 5279, or go online to kcrw.com/give. You are the salsa to our tortillas. Give us some sazon.
give us some caliente, right? Look, folks, I've been proud to be a contributor to KCRW now, since at least 2004. So we're talking about 16 years. I started off with Evan's show with Good Food. I eventually graduated to having my own weekly segment, The Orange County Line, with Steve Chiotakis. Hola, Steve. Hola. Gracias. You know, every once in a while, I come out on Left, Right, and Center. When Madeline Brand needs someone to give her some giggles, she has me on. And KCRW has also been kind enough and smart enough to do something like this tortilla tournament. What other public radio station, not just in Southern California, but across the United States, has the audacity to celebrate tortillas, to tell people to go to these mom-and-pop operations run by people of color, run by immigrants, and say, hey, go eat good tortillas? It's KCRW, so please be a member. Go to kcrw.com/give. Give, give, give. Become a member. And if you're a member, guess what? Then you get to go to our October 18th Zoom finale for the tortilla tournament for free. And you're not just supporting KCRW, you're supporting all the personalities that you love, your Evan Kleinmans, your Steve Chiotakis's. There's only one Steve Chiotakis, although maybe there should be another one. Malin Brands, everyone. So please, kcrw.com/give. KCRW, the only people smart enough to cover tortillas, and also the only public radio station smart enough to cover Orange County as we do through the Orange County line.
One last reminder, join us tomorrow, Sunday, October 18th at 4 o'clock for a virtual celebration of the tortilla and to watch Gustavo and me, along with judges Mona Holmes and Connie Alvarez, as we taste our way to the number one tortilla in Southern California. When we come back, we'll hear about the World Food Program. The organization was just awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. I'll learn all about it next. I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food. Hunger. You hear us talk about it on this show and during every pledge drive when all of us exhort you to support the LA Food Bank. It's a problem. But our problems here in LA, as bad as they are dwarfed by the urgency of the need worldwide. When we heard that the World Food Program won this year's Nobel Peace Prize, it was especially sweet news during a difficult year. Jonathan Dumont joins us. He's the head of emergency communication for the organization. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How long have you worked for the World Food Program?
Since 2003, I've worked for the World Food Program.
When was it established?
Well, it was in the 60s. Basically, it was a joint partisan initiative by Bob Dole and George McGovern to find a way to use food in the U.S. that could be used in places where there wasn't any.
And what is its relationship to the U.N.?
We're the United Nations' largest humanitarian organization. We're the frontline emergency relief operation. So whenever there's an emergency, we're the ones who are the first people in, bringing in everything from food, of course, but to IT support, medicine for WHO, shelter for the UNHCR, and every other organization that needs to get places to where it's needed in a hurry.
And who supports it?
Well, it's everybody. The United States is a huge donor, the European Union, Japan, and then unilaterally Germany, UK, Gulf states, and now we're hoping some billionaires as well.
Just to give us an idea of the size of the food operation, how much food is moved in a year?
I'm not sure how many metric tons of food are moved, but we feed about, this year, more than 100 million people, basically because of the effects of what COVID has done on supply chains throughout the world, and that's caused us to have to increase our caseload. Most of our biggest emergencies are driven by conflict and so are very vulnerable to any sort of disruptions in getting food into those areas because these are insecure areas and already cut off. So once you disrupt the supply chains from other parts of the world, it makes it even more challenging.
When it started in the 60s, it was a way for U.S. farmers to get rid of surplus. Is it like that now, or is the food sourced from other places?
No, we don't. That may have been your grandfather's emergency relief operation, but at the beginning, it was actually, it was USDA food that was then channeled to what we now call USAID. But what happens now is we try to, number one, whenever possible, buy food locally and many times in the same country itself. So that helps the local economies. And increasingly, we're trying to use cash. So with that cash, it enables people who need food to buy it and then on local markets and then support the local markets, even, you know, not just from suppliers, but all the way down up the supply chain and from shops to transporters to everybody.
And I understand that those financial grants are being used, especially in concert ahead of climate events.
We do have a mechanism that we've put in place to give people small funds in advance of a climate, like a big storm or when we know there's a drought coming, so that they can prepare themselves. A lot of what we do is forecasting, is trying to be ahead of the curve so we're not broadsided by an emergency, whether it be a conflict or climate, you know, a big storm or a drought or El Nino or something that will have an effect on local food supplies. And then, of course, with conflict, it gets a little difficult because you're trying to predict where people will move. In a place like South Sudan, which has very few roads anyway, if there's fighting in one area, people will move into another area, and very frequently those areas are inaccessible. So it all comes down to, if you're talking about food, pre-positioning it in a place where people are. But then if they move, you have to resort to more drastic measures, which include airdrops, which are a last resort for WFP, because they're very expensive.
What's the most recent mission you've been on where you were just really struck by the logistics involved to get food where it needed to go?
Well, I was in Burkina Faso, Niger last week. And in Burkina Faso, you have a combination of conflict and drought. You have an insurgency that in little more than a year has displaced 1.2 million people. And the insurgency is affecting three countries, Mali, Niger, and Burkina Faso. And they're coming from the northern part of Burkina Faso, pushing people, displacing people down into the south, but also isolating people in the north. And so right now in the northern areas on the border near Mali, we have pockets of famine. We have an estimate of 11,000 people who are in what we call phase five famine-like conditions. And the challenge of this is how do we get food to these people who are cut off by insurgents? It's a very dangerous area right over the border from there in Niger, where I was last week as well. There was recently eight French aid workers who were killed. Some American soldiers have been killed there in recent years, and it's a very dangerous place. And so, you know, the logistics of getting food in there is really challenging, but we'll figure it out. That's what we do.
These areas that you're speaking about, are they also the areas of the greatest need right now?
Well, our biggest emergencies right now are South Sudan. That's been a conflict that's been going on since the birth of that nation. Yemen, which is, I think we're in the fifth year of the fighting there. We're really worried about another insurgency that's affecting northern Mozambique that's displacing a lot of people. The Cox's Bazar situation with the Rohingya who have been forced out of Myanmar into Bangladesh. And there's, you know, that's the largest refugee camp in the world right now. And then, of course, we have the Congo, DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, where you have a witch's brew of hunger, fighting, Ebola, and now COVID, of course, which is, you know, affecting movement of things around there. And then just sort of a lot of ongoing conflicts in places like the Central African Republic, which are have just taken a very poor country and made it even worse. And yes, also this three countries in the Sahel, Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. We're in a situation now, when I first started at WFP, we would have one or two big emergencies a year, like a tsunami or a big earthquake or maybe a protracted conflict like Darfur. But now recently we've had up to seven or eight simultaneous, what we call L3 emergencies, which are affecting massive numbers of people, involve a lot of sort of resources and food.
You know, this link between hunger and conflict is so devastating. Does it create a cycle?
Basically, yeah, there is a cycle between hunger and conflict and then migration. Or if you're trapped somewhere, then, you know, that's going to cause more hunger. And very often hunger will cause conflict. So, yeah, it is definitely a cycle that we see. When there's food shortages, whether it's caused by conflict or climate changes or whatever, or even high food prices, then that's when, you know, other problems occur, whether it's fighting or migration or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, people need to eat. What kind of foods does the World Food Program provide?
Well, when we do provide food, it's there's staples like cooking oil. Depending on what the population eats, it can be millet, corn, sorghum, flour, sugar, salt, you know, the basic staples that people use, rice, in whatever region it's the issue is, wherever the hunger is.
Do you get involved in infant nutrition? I would imagine that the plight of children in these situations is even more urgent.
Yeah, for children, we have special nutritional foods. Some are peanut-based. Some are a combination, a porridge mixed with powdered milk, sugar, and some vitamins. And then we have other sort of nutritional sprinkles that we use. There's a wide variety of fortified foods we use for mothers, you know, and for children.
So what was the reaction, the organization's reaction to the win of the Nobel Prize?
Well, I was in Niger with the head of the organization, and we're actually, after a week's trip, we were on our way back when we heard the news. And of course, we were pretty amazed and extremely happy. And I mean, we view this as an affirmation that the world recognizes the importance of the problem of hunger and that it must be tackled. So for us, it gives us more initiative and more will and more energy to fight the big fight, because it is a big fight. I mean, the COVID pandemic is having economic effects and globally, and donors are going to tighten their belts. And we think that's inevitable next year. And on the other hand, we've seen that recently during COVID, some companies have done very well. They've actually made money. So we're hoping now that those people will realize that this is a moment to give back, and this is a way that people can try to do some good with the fortune they've had to actually make a lot of money.
Thank you so much, Jonathan, for taking the time.
Well, thank you.
Jonathan Dumont is the head of emergency communication at the World Food Program. The organization was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for its efforts to combat hunger. You can find the URL to donate to the World Food Program on our website, kcrw.com/goodfood. But you can do your part in combating hunger right here in LA when you become a member or renew your membership at KCRW. Instead of selecting a thank you gift, you can choose to support the Los Angeles Regional Food Bank or the Food Bank of Santa Barbara County. It's a win-win. You can support the programming you love while donating meals to the hungry. Just go to kcrw.com/give. And last but not least, let's close out the show with the market report. Jillian Ferguson is there now.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. One of the many benefits of shopping the farmers market is that Logan Williams of Logan's Gardens is here every week with a huge assortment of vegetables, herbs, and fruit for your edible garden. Logan, you're right in the middle of the market. No one can miss you if they're walking through here. Now that we're leaving the summer harvest behind, I'd love for you to share a few ideas for our fall and winter gardens. What should we be planting this time of year?
Well, you actually came and asked me that on a great day, to tell you the truth there. Right now, you can do pretty much all your kales, perfectly great time for those. All your lettuces, great time for those. You can do any of your arugulas, you can still do, of which we have several as well. And a big thing we're really excited about this year is we're doing probably our widest selection of mustard greens and Asian greens, as many as we've ever done, actually. So we have a wide assortment of those as well.
Okay, so something like kale, you plant it and it keeps producing throughout the season. What about these other lettuces that you mentioned, the Asian greens, the arugula? When you plant them, do you continue to get a harvest throughout the season?
Not quite the same for every variety. Just like with people, there's different sorts of everything within even one category of plant. So on lettuces, there are certain varieties which will last you not quite so long, maybe like one season, basically. Whereas there are some other types of lettuces we're very excited about. There's this category of lettuce called Salanovas. And the Salanova lettuces get, not only are they quite large-headed, but they actually last you a little bit longer than the traditional lettuces, so sometimes even surpassing one season. So those last you a great deal. The kale, as we were talking about earlier, the kales will last you sometimes up to a year in Southern California especially. Then you have your other things that are going well right now, like your cauliflowers, broccolis. Those guys are certainly going to last you a while, especially if you get them in right now. It's a great time for those. And you still have plenty of time to plant the vast majority of your perennial herbs as well.
Yeah, talk to us about winter herbs. For instance, there's winter savory versus summer savory.
Even that is just a name, guys. The winter and summer savories are actually both perennial herbs, so those are both grown throughout the year. However, there are certain herbs that are, I don't want to say going away, but they're definitely going to start winding down, really not in fall, but really in winter. Mostly being like your basils, you're going to start to see less and less of those, not just available for me, but available even at the farmer's market as we get more towards winter here. However, the vast majority of the other herbs you can still do right now, those being your parsley, you can still do your mint, your lavender, your sages, your rosemary, all of those things are still totally plantable right now.
You know, in the summertime, people often call tomatoes the gateway vegetable, right? Like, they're so satisfying to grow. Not only are they so much more delicious when you grow them yourselves than when you buy them in the grocery store, but there's something immensely satisfying about seeing the fruits ripen. I wonder, is there a winter equivalent to a tomato that maybe a first-time gardener who started gardening this summer during the pandemic wants to sort of extend that excitement into the new season? What would you recommend?
I would again be going back to what we were touching on earlier. I would say that would probably be a lot of your different winter and fall greens. Like we were speaking about the mustards and Asian greens earlier. Those guys, we have a variety of different ones in a variety of different colors. So just to be able to put in a few greens, a few purples, a few dark red greens, and to see those really come to fruition and really start to pop with the color is really a shockingly fun experience, especially for a new gardener. You kind of didn't know there were this many colors of all these different greens. So when you plant a few of those and do a nice mix of them, that can be a really, really fun thing to do in the fall, winter.
Logan, I also noticed you had some strawberries over there. What variety are those?
Well, we have some really, really fantastic strawberries I'm actually excited about right now. We have a variety called Ugalulla, which is kind of our standard around here. It has a funny name, but it's a really, really good medium-sized berry. Then the one I'm probably most excited about is actually a German heirloom variety called Mietze Schindler. The new modern 2020 nickname for them is actually Strassberry, because they have obviously the flesh or skin of a strawberry, but actually the more bulbish sort of rounded shape of a raspberry, and just incredibly bold, tangy yet very sweet flavor. Even a darker green leaf, it's a really striking plant overall, as well as the berries being just incredible. So those are another thing you can get in now, and they'll do absolutely fine for you. So strawberry is definitely one of my picks for this time of year.
All right, full sun for the strawberries?
You can do them in full sun. However, strawberries, even if you're more coastal, they are one you can get away with in around 3.5 to 4 hours of sun.
All right, and I imagine that we need to prep our soil a little bit. If we're taking out the tomatoes, the peppers, how do we transition our beds to plant again?
Well, you definitely want to fertilize with a good organic fertilizer of your choosing there. We at Logan's Gardens are always going to recommend you use something organic. So whatever works best for you. I feel like people kind of know their gardens, but you definitely want to fertilize with something that's going to be a little bit higher in potassium and magnesium if you could. That's going to help a lot of your winter vegetables actually produce the flowers and eventually vegetables that you want from them. So definitely something that's decent in potassium and magnesium.
Okay, and last but not least, you do have a number of trees here as well, a lot of fruit trees, pomegranates, finger limes, all of the citrus, really. Are these trees that we could take home and plant in pots?
Yeah, the vast majority of the trees you get from me are varieties that you can do in larger pots. We sell them in 5-gallon pots. If you were planting them in a pot, or let's say you had a balcony or some sort of area where you just wanted to get a couple plants in there, you could definitely do them in a around a 15-gallon pot, so roughly 3 times the size of the pots that you'll see them in here. We even recommend actually those half wine barrels are great. If you ever see any of those are great to get and put a larger fruit tree in. Heck, you can even put a bunch of your greens and herbs in a wine barrel and get a good deal of them in there, even if you don't have a ground space, for example. So there's different ways to do different things.
All right. Well, Logan, it's beautiful as always. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you guys so much.
That was Logan Williams of Logan's Gardens. You can find him at the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica markets, the Sunday market, and also by appointment only at their nursery in Silver Lake. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laro Garcia, and Desmond Taylor. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. It is great to have you back, Gary. Support KCRW. Support independent radio, just like you support independent restaurants. If you want to know how to take direct action in your community and truly make a difference, I'll tell you right now, support us during this drive. I know that times are tough, so I'm asking you to give what you can. Go to kcrw.com/give and put Good Food in the comments of your donation so that I may personally thank you next week on air. Until then, be safe, eat well, and don't forget to tip. I'll be back next week with more good food.